Philip Morgan.
LW, how's it going?
L-dub in the house. It's good, man. You may hear my dog snoring occasionally because he's next to me and he's a loud breather.
He snores? That's so cute.
It is really cute, actually.
I love that. My dog used to snore.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, it's going well, man. Just a day packed, jam-packed with phone calls today. So I've been... It is 11:46 Pacific Standard Time, and this is my fourth phone call of the day.
Woo. Packing them in, buddy.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm good. I just wrapped up the last Q&A session on the first workshop in Specialization School, which is a series of three workshops followed by one open-ended coaching program designed to help people, you know, completely make that journey from generalist to in-demand specialist. So the first workshop worked up, already getting positive feedback about it. It was kind of weird. It wasn't not that many people showed up for the Q&A session. There were some excused absences. One guy had jury duty, which I totally understand. Another guy had a sick kid. And then there were a few like, why didn't that guy show up? They've been here every other time. So anyway, overall, it went well. This ties into our topic today, where we're going to talk about making big, significant changes to our businesses. This specialization school is, in my mind, the future of my business. It's me taking stuff I've done ad hoc, you know, sort of on a one-off basis and starting to systematize it so that it can be A, less subject to me forgetting stuff. You know, if you're like working with, let's say 10 or 20 people, each one you're treating as a unique, special case, then you can miss things. And I think I have done that, to be honest. I'm not happy or proud about that, but I think I have been like, oh, wow, I did the process a little differently for you than I did for you. I feel like I've been doing this long enough and seen enough instances of different situations where I'm seeing what they all have in common. And that's why I feel comfortable starting to impose a sort of everybody does this process kind of thing on it. People can hire me if they don't want to do that, to work one-on-one with them, and they can pay more than they would pay. But I'm starting to think that there's a lot of value to saying, well, this is the process for executing this change in your business from generalist to specialist. That's what specialization school is me formalizing the process. And I'm like stoked, super stoked about it, and not as terrified as I would expect, because I don't have any evidence yet that there's demand for this whole thing. The first workshop sold out, which was, I guess, partial evidence, but I haven't really exposed my list to the subsequent offers, which are a little more advanced, and I'm not sure how they're going to sell. So I'm putting a lot of eggs in this basket. And my style for doing that is, like, I'm a very mild-mannered person, as you know, but I'm surprisingly aggressive about jumping into new things in my business, and it cranks the risk up a lot when I do that.
Well, hold on. Let me stop you there, because I know this is the topic du jour and I want to get to it, but I did want to follow up with one thing you said, which was you weren't quite as terrified as you would have expected now that you're putting this process and a lot of structure in place.
Right.
What are some of the reasons you thought you might be terrified to do this? Because I'm selfishly, I want to know about this because I received this feedback yesterday. You know, you should put more structure on this. And I had some thoughts about it, but I was wondering what's so terrifying about that idea?
The structure or the more general making a big change? Because it's really the second that I feel like should be more terrifying to me than it actually is at this point.
Okay, however you want to answer.
All right, sure. I'm not worried about the structure. Like, that's the part of me that says this is the future of my business, is to more formalize this process, make it available at a different variety of price points so that some people, if all they can afford is something that is basically a book, then they can get a sort of book version of the same process. But others who want more of a high touch, ask questions when I get stuck kind of environment can pay more and get that. So that part doesn't terrify me at all. That's like so clearly what I think needs to happen. It's so clearly going to be beneficial once I have really refined that more. So I'm not worried about that. What I am worried about is I don't have a backup plan, but I'm less worried than I would expect about that. I don't have a good backup
plan. Well, you do have a backup plan. Actually, I challenge you on that. Your backup plan is the 3 years of hustle and marketing you've been putting into your business as it exists now. So you can still sell one-on-one coaching or your existing group program the way it is, even if this doesn't work out, correct?
Well, that's something I want to dive into deeper with you is what...
Okay.
The thing we forgot to mention in our summary episodes, we had considered calling this the Tough Love Podcast because that would have been fun to mention. I'm going to need some tough love for you about what the backup plan would be because I think you are a man who has, over the past year, some experience with backup plans.
Oh my God. Yeah.
So I want to hear what backup plan you would suggest for me, but let's just put a pin in that part for later. Okay. So maybe I do, maybe I don't have a good backup plan. You're right. I have an asset in the form of a very engaged email list, which I think I mentioned last week is now half the size it used to be.
Congratulations.
Anyway, thank you. Yeah.
They didn't deserve you, Philip.
See ya. 2,000 losers who are gone. No.
Slow down, Turbo. Not losers, but not engaged members of your email list.
Poor fit. Bad fit. Okay, so I've got some assets, sure. Here's what it feels like is I'm putting so much of my attention that I worry that it's becoming tunnel vision. And when I say a worry, again, I'm not worrying as much as I would expect myself to be worrying about this.
Sure.
But whatever worry is there, it's in the form of, what if I'm starving? Like, here's what I did early on in my freelancing career. I get a client. I would focus completely on them. I would stop doing business development. Guess what that meant? Project ended, and I'm like, great, where's the next project?
Yeah. Oh, and, shit. What yeah, now?
Exactly. Which is just stupid. It's sort of like eating a meal and then expecting the next meal to just show up without doing anything. It's just stupid. But a lot of us make that mistake, right? I don't know if you ever did. You seem like an entirely far more put-together person than me in general. But I'm curious if you ever made that mistake.
Of course.
Okay.
Of course. So I mean, and the reality is, I think the mistake is a little bit more complicated than you lead on. And that is, this is the mistake I've made. And I know a lot of people who do this. They sell 100% of their time, right? And now I have no mental energy and no physical energy even to put into continually marketing myself.
Right.
And then when it ends, as a function of literally not having the time to do anything else, I now have nothing else going on, right? Because I didn't give myself a chance to have something else going on. And so I think the lesson that I learned the hard way, like mm-hmm. most people do, mm-hmm. is selling all of your time cannot be the goal, right? You need to allocate, I usually recommend 50% of your time to marketing, selling, and building your business simply because it's a nice, easy rule of thumb and it means you need to double your prices.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's a variation that I realized. I think for me, the first big project showed up essentially by luck. So I thought mm-hmm. that's how the second one will show up. Same way, right? It'll just show up when the time is right. It'll arrive when it's needed. So anyway, that... that doesn't usually happen that many times in a row.
That's quite the leap.
So I have this fear deeply embedded in me. If I divert too much attention to a thing and I'm not constantly putting intentional energy into marketing and cultivating future business, that I'm going to reach this cliff and it's just going to be a drop off. But maybe that's not actually what I'm doing here because I am building a thing that I do fully intend to market the heck out of and sell the heck out of, but it's just unproven, right? It's based on quite a bit of experience and what I know people need help with. And it's exactly the kind of help I've given people in my positioning accelerator program. It's just formalized into a kind of productized service or a training offering.
Right. And so to add a little more detail to this discussion, you're essentially taking what used to be one-on-one coaching or slightly, I don't want to say amorphous, but less structured group environments into something that has a clear structure day one through day 60. Here's all the stuff we're going to do. Here's what it costs. Here's when it starts. And so it's much more tangible and much more productized, like training would be, rather than coaching, correct?
That is 100% correct.
Okay, cool.
And so that comes with, you know, the normal concerns. I think they're normal concerns about, well, what if it, you know, the product market fit is not quite right, to borrow a term from the startup world. I think it's pretty close. It's not, it's based on far more insight into my market than somebody would have for a market they don't know. Because I've been serving this market in a really, you know, sort of close capacity for years now. So maybe I should trust myself more. And maybe that's why I'm not so panicky about the whole thing as I would expect. And maybe I do kind of feel this sort of humming. Like, have you ever stood on a train or stood on a bridge when a train goes right underneath it, like a locomotive train?
Sure.
That feeling of like power is overwhelming. It's just amazing. It's like standing under, you know, by Niagara Falls or something, where you're just like blown away with the sort of physicality of it. And I kind of feel that with my list, not quite at that scale, but still this, it's a solid feeling. It's like, this is going to support me. This is, you know, this is an asset I've built up. People talk about it like a flywheel. Mm-hmm. And it has that feeling. It's just kind of humming there. And of course, I'm feeding it and really showing up in the best way I know how to daily for those people to try to help, try to contribute. So it's, you know, it's not like just a gift. I built it up, but I think that might be part of why I'm not freaking out about this change.
Hmm. Okay. Well, and so your biggest fear, if I understand correctly, is what if you put time and energy into building this new program at the expense of marketing everything else that you already know that's working? Is that right?
Yep. And then, you know, like next month, April is like sales month for this thing. That's when I'm going to sell the next two workshops and coincidentally build them since they're new. So, yeah, it's a, like, well, what if the sales are not enough? You know, what am I going to do then?
Now, let me ask you this. Are you only selling to your existing list, or are you going to, you know, seek out new people who might be a fit for this because your customer is slightly different?
Right now, it's just to my list.
Okay.
Yeah, just to my list.
Yeah. All right. So I think your fears are unfounded, and here's why.
Thank God.
All of the voice all of the sanity. Stuff. Yeah. Unfortunately, this will not be the Tough Love podcast.
Okay.
This will be like the Nice Compliment podcast.
It's good. It's all going to be okay podcast.
Right. My feeling is because you've done the same type of marketing to the same types of people, and this is for that same customer, as long as you don't let go of your marketing, maybe put your marketing in maintenance mode. And I don't know what that means for you, but I know you still do a daily email, but you know, I think the real question is, well, how do you get people onto the email list? That's what you need to put into maintenance mode. So if that's one podcast a week, or if that's, you know, one new asset that you create a month and it brings people to your website, whatever that is, mm-hmm. do that minimum amount so that you still have a chance to bring in enough people, a maintenance mode level of people, into your fold. They can see this new workshop, but they're also exposed to all of your other service offerings. If the workshop didn't work out, you still have the fallback of, hey, I'm still the same guy who I've always been, and I can help you in these other ways that are totally proven and work, and I have heaps of testimonials about what people got out of them.
Yeah. You know, the problem, maybe not a problem, but the challenge continues to be that the most revenue that I can get from a single person is my most expensive, you know, one-on-one coaching offering. So
right.
That feels like the thing I have the least predictability around selling. And that's maybe that's what actually worries me, because that would be like the backup plan is, hey, let's kind of promote this and see if there's anybody interested. So, but I think you're right that there's enough momentum that I think that's really the reason I'm not freaking out is part of my mind is like, well, this is a big change. It's risky. But then another part of me just kind of feels this momentum and trusts it a bit, yeah. You know?
I mean, I think the one thing that I would introduce to you here is when I think about training or workshops, the business model is I need a lot of people exposed to this idea so that I have a high enough percentage taking the offer because mm-hmm. there's a volume element to it.
Sure.
However, if you think about doing a custom consulting engagement or a coaching engagement, you need one taker to that to really move the needle for you revenue-wise.
Yeah, that's all it takes.
So the requirements are much different.
Yeah.
Right? So that's why I'm saying, you know, you shouldn't feel hesitation or any fear around this because the amount of work, I don't want to say the amount of work, but the number of people you would need to take your offer for a higher ticket thing mm-hmm. is very low. One or two people makes a huge difference for you. And so, you know, to me, that fallback is like totally reasonable, always within reach, and is available to you anytime you want it.
One of the assets that I have is like, it's not hard for me to email my list every day. I have the habit built up. I've been doing it since January 2016. It's not that hard. Emailing every day makes it very easy to spontaneously put an offer out there to increase revenue. Mm-hmm. So if it's Wednesday today, if I'm like next week, I want to try to increase my revenue, I can do that. If I was emailing once a week or once a month, the lead time for putting an offer in front of my list and doing a sort of sequential selling thing where I kind of build up interest in that would be much, much longer. So I think that's another reason why, like, that's not a specific plan B, but that's like the speed of execution for a plan B for me is a lot faster than it would be if I was emailing less frequently.
Mm.
So that, I think, also gives me this sense of comfort around making the change. Like, okay, if I need to improvise a shitty plan B, I think I can pull that off if I have to.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I agree with that. I think also, like, you could just say, hey, everybody, like, I have a single slot opening for a high-level engagement with anybody who wants to dramatically reshape and position their business in the next month. Are you or someone you know interested? And I think you would get responses to that. So,
you know, now that you mentioned that.
Don't worry
that,
about it, man.
Thank you, buddy. I'm just remembering. So I had a one-on-one coaching guy this month, and he had one of the more complex situations that I've dealt with recently. And I was able to use this workshop that I've already created for specialization school as the framework for him working through this complex specialization question on his own, partially on his own. We still checked in like I would with any one-on-one coaching person. But I had an additional tool for him to use to help kind of resolve his problem. And he got to the point of clarity faster than I've ever seen any one-on-one coaching person do it. Part of that was him, because he has some time to put into it right now. But also part of it was I'm getting better at doing that. So this is not just, you know, the fluff fill-up session here, even though it seems like it's turning into that. I still do want to talk more generally about making a big, scary change to your business. But that's also encouraging to see that he made like record progress through a challenging situation with, because I added an asset to it that I didn't have there before. I gave him this tool to use. So that makes me think that that would be an increased value in the one-on-one coaching that I could, if I needed to, that to be the plan B for April, if sales are not what they need to be for this, for specialization school, I've got that too. So,
well, so I want to share an insight that I had, in my business recently, but before I do that, can we go back to when you first had the idea to make this big change in your business and to essentially restructure and reformat the way you deliver help to clients, and basically in what way and what do they pay and how long does it take and how do they experience all of it? How did you originally come up with this conception, and how did you arrive at the decision to actually go forward with it?
So, it's a little bit of an embarrassing story. So I watched some webinar, but I think that's better for the listeners if it's kind of funny or embarrassing. So I watched this webinar. This was a good year ago, probably.
Okay.
I don't know exactly when, but that's the rough time frame we're talking about. And it was just one of those things that you see on Facebook if you're in my demographic. I don't know if people in other demographics see it, but if you're in my demographic, you get targeted for these kinds of ads. For a while, it was that guy, Sam Ovens, who's like, I'll you know, help you build a million dollar consultant or whatever.
Right.
And it's almost like a parade of these offers that get put in front of me on Facebook. It's actually very interesting to see what sort of sponsored bullshit shows up in my feed, because it almost is like a reflection on me and what my aspirations are. Anyway, sometimes it's hilarious when it's a product like some dumb gizmo somebody's doing on Kickstarter. So I saw this thing. I went to the guy's webinar, and it was basically sort of repping this very common idea that you can build this wildly successful business with the following formula. Paid ad traffic, sending people to a webinar, pitching some expensive program.
Was it Russ Ruffino?
That's a familiar name. No, it wasn't Russ's. I don't know Russ, but I recognize his bald head anywhere. Probably a very similar thing, but it was some kind of different.
Oh, is it Michael Port, the bald head?
No, he's doing speaking training now.
Right. Well, anyway,
wait, no, it doesn't Russ, matter. Is that Russ Ruffino? Okay, there's some other guy that's...
Russ Ruffino is not bald. That's why I asked.
Okay. All these guys blend together. They all look the same. That's my racist internet marketer statement of the week.
It's okay. Anyway, we'll try to ignore it.
Somebody else. Ignore my internet marketer racism. Maybe that's not going to come across as funny to people, but I think the idea of being racist towards internet marketers is hilarious because they are almost a race of their own. They're so weird and different. I'm just digging myself in deeper here.
Yep, you are. Continue with your story, please.
So I was like, okay, I'll put something together like that. So I came up with this idea called Specialization School, and it was, you know, it was that idea, but it was a version one. I don't love the version one. I sold it to one guy who I think it was helpful for. It was basically me doing a lot of stuff that my students have been unsuccessful at doing on their own. So it was like me doing more of the market research, more of the outreach, more of the, but the problem with it is I'm just not good at that stuff. I'm not good at doing things for other people. I'm much better at helping them learn and get the inspiration and motivation to do it themselves.
Okay.
So version two of Specialization School became this. So that's how it started. Listen, is I watched a cheesy webinar, got intrigued with the idea and thought I would try it out myself, and built Specialization School as an offer that I thought I could sell in that way. Tweaked it substantially, and now I'm much happier with this new version, which is basically, again, it's a series of three workshops and one open-ended coaching program. So it's all about helping people gain this capability to do it themselves in their business, the capability to specialize in a way that really works for them. So I forgot your second question, but that was the first one, is how, that's how the idea came about.
And then how did you decide to actually move forward and act on it? Was it like, hey, this would be interesting if it worked, let's see. Was it as simple as that? You were just going to do an experiment?
No, it was more practical and functional. So I have this product called the Positioning Course that has sold to a number of people. And it was meant to be a course-like experience for a lot of the content that's in the positioning manual. It was fine. It was a, you know, kind of a rough version one. And I was like, okay, first quarter 2018, that's when I'm going to redo that product, make it better. Mm-hmm. I got into the planning stages for reworking that product and started planning out something where I was like, oh, this feels different. And what if I sort of questioned some of my assumptions about the original product. The original product was very monolithic. It had a ton of stuff packed into this one course. Newbie product creator thinks, oh, that adds value. You know, it's like somehow the value is measured by like the word count or, you know, you've seen those courses where it's like 200 hours of video training and they're bragging about the length of it.
Right.
And what you realize once you get past that bare newbie stage with stuff like this is that doesn't change people's lives. What changes people's lives is stuff that's small enough that they can actually follow through on it,
right,
and digest it, and it's actionable. And so I started to apply that thinking to reworking the position course, and I was like, oh, this needs to be multiple separate courses. Mm-hmm. That maybe people buy it as a bundle, but there needs to be some divisions in here. This stuff needs to be chopped up and divided up. So I just kind of ran with that idea, and it seemed to break down into these three workshops, one of which is optional. It's fully optional based on where you land at the end of the first workshop. And I was like, okay, this kind of turned into a bigger project. And then I just sort of rolled it under the brand name or the idea of Specialization School. And it all started to make a lot more sense to me when I thought about it that way. So that's how I sort of got to where it is today.
Interesting. Okay. Well, so
I still have not redone the positioning course, but now that, because that became a bigger project, the people who, in case anybody happens to be listening who bought that product, they are going to get access to the better version of it. That is Specialization School for no extra cost. Anyway, go ahead and listen.
Right. I was going to say, my guess is you would transition those folks to Specialization School, and if Specialization School turns out to be the more effective way to deliver that content, you would just eventually retire the positioning course, correct?
I've already stopped promoting the positioning course for that reason. I already feel so strongly that this is going to be better. So each of those workshops is delivered as a sort of a live workshop. There's like live meetings every week. I will turn those into a self-study version. Mm. So that'll be available at some kind of lower price point. So that'll kind of be the equivalent to the position course product. And that's what people are going to get free access to if they bought the position course. So anyway, lots of details there.
Okay. So I can share a few changes that I've made in my business. I mean, it's sort of like, how long does everybody have? But
I know that's a big part of the first 26 episodes of this podcast that we just deleted.
Right. And that's actually for the benefit of everybody listening. I can promise.
It's for your own good. Trust us.
You're better off listening from episode 27 on, and not anything prior to that. But what I wanted to share is something that I learned this week. And so I have a client who is totally advisory, and I'm actually pitching them on doing a little closer help with them for some of their sales program. And simply because I've identified lots of ways that I could help them, and they need help, and we trust each other and everything's clicking, right? So I'm going to offer that. And while I was talking to my client, who's the CEO of this company, he goes, you know, I also have like 30 account managers in my business and I don't have any salespeople and they have no sales training and they're not comfortable with it. He's like, we should probably talk about how you could get in front of them and help them be better at sales too.
Did this CEO require any prompting to do that? Or did it was just like, here, would you like to have dramatically more business from us?
Funny story, Philip. So I did my Sales in 30 experiment on LinkedIn, www.salesin30.com, if you want to get the free 10 video course.
Yep.
And I just published it. And lo and behold, he watched some of those videos.
Oh, wow.
And so I didn't prompt him at all. He was just like, oh, yeah, I've been I asked him, like, of course, I would love to do that. You know, what's prompting this? And he goes, well, I've been watching your videos on LinkedIn, and that's exactly the kind of help we need.
Look at you, clever marketer, you.
Well, so if I were able to get just this project out of the Sales in 30 course, like, it would pay way more dividends than I ever would have imagined.
Sounds like it. That's great.
But it got me thinking, right? A lot of the content I've been creating is around sales conversations. And when I talk to independent people, and you know this from your work, their primary challenge is I don't get enough leads, right? But if I'm an agency, probably my primary challenge is I'm not getting better leads, or I have people in a selling situation who are just kind of skating by because of nothing that I've done, but because they're good enough naturally that they can do the job, but they could definitely be better. Now, that seems like a really interesting market. And I wanted to piggyback on something you said earlier, which is about how if in your workshop, even if the workshop doesn't work out for whatever reason, who knows, you get an accelerated level of experience working with more people faster. You learn a lot more about what their needs are.
Right.
Now, ultimately, what I want to do is change the way a million independent business owners work.
Right.
Right. Like, that would be amazing. If I could teach people, you know, if someone's making 60,000 and I can help them make 80,000, increase their business by a third based on a book that I write or a workshop that they take of mine, that would be amazing. Like, that would be a huge life change for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But to work with all of them individually is very difficult.
Indeed.
And whereas if, like, let's look at this client's business, you know, if I get in front of 10, 20, 30 account managers, what I learned from that experience would be probably 6 to 12 months worth of learning from individual clients.
Mm-hmm.
It would be tremendous. And of course, this comes with a really natural fit for a training program, lots of structure, bigger price tag, obviously. It's worth way more to him than it is to individual clients.
Right.
And I went, huh, that's something I should have thought about on my own. But, you know, I'm big on, I tell people, have as many conversations as you can, because this is the kind of thing that comes up.
Yeah.
Right. You're just like, oh, I didn't see that. I should have seen it, but because I'm doing the right things, eventually it came to fruition.
I'm not sure you could have seen that. Like, I mean, maybe we're just debating something that's not all that important, but I just, I think it just comes back to what you said. It's like, it comes out of the conversations, because that's how you get in their world.
Right.
Is by showing up for those conversations, being curious, being present, digging a little bit, not being satisfied with simple answers. So I'm just not sure there's any real substitute for that that doesn't involve the conversation.
Right.
Anyway, so that's very cool.
So that's cool, right? And that would involve a significant change to the amount of structure I have, which is very little, as I said at the top. You know, I know what those trigger problems are that people have. So the trigger problems typically are, I need to know more people in my market. So I need some type of lead generation or an acceleration to the types of relationships I can build. I need to have more effective sales conversations, or I need sort of infrastructure, tools, and structure, methodologies, ways of doing things in my sales process. Those are like the three big things that I'm hearing over and over again. Yeah. And you know, hearing this from my client, I thought, well, there's an interesting application of what I'm already doing and creating on a regular basis that gives much more leverage to my clients and to me, and would allow me more time, let's be honest, to go and create the next thing for maybe a slightly different market and continue to do training for larger companies.
Yeah. Nice. I'm curious how, in light of this larger idea of making big changes to your business, how do you think about risk? Mm-hmm. You know, at those inflection points where you're like, we haven't really defined the change. The change might be a change in positioning, or it might be adding a new service offering and getting rid of old ones. What other things qualify as big changes? I don't have any experience at all with the idea of adding an employee. I know that's a big change.
That is a big change. And my guess is if I were doing two training engagements with 10 or more people a month, I'd probably mm-hmm. want to add someone to keep the mm-hmm. trains running on time, kind of a project manager type.
Yeah.
But I think the one thing that I continue to think about is the other big ripple effect would be my messaging, right? Yeah. So for instance, the person who says, I have 20 account managers and I need them to get better at selling. Like, mm-hmm. why wouldn't I message on that directly?
Right.
Like, you're a consulting company and you have all of these people who are great at managing projects. Let's put them in a position to sell more effectively, right? Because that's part of their job. And it's your direct line to revenue and you're spending no time practicing that. So let me help you practice that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Versus my existing messaging is around selling with confidence, which I think can still work, but it wouldn't be targeted at the individual business owner. So like in this scenario, my buyer is the CEO of a company with say 20 to 100 people. And so they're going to say, how do I make my team more effective? So I'm not going to message on how do you be more effective. It's going to be about your team and your employees and leverage and expanding clients and better service delivery, right?
Yeah.
It will be significantly different.
Yeah, I'd say that's a positioning change that implies a messaging change.
Yes.
So it's about to get wild up in here. We got a cat up on the fireplace about to knock over the thing that's supposed to keep him from getting up on the fireplace, which is this can full of coins. Anyway,
I was imagining it was like a plastic owl with spikes on it.
We need something better. If any of our listeners have a suggestion for keeping animals, beloved animals, not animals you're wanting to hurt in the process, but off of surfaces, I'd love to hear it. Anyway, so how do you think about the risk factor in making a change like this? If you've got, like, I've worked with plenty of clients who have, when I ask what their runway is, and I ask it by saying, if you've got no more new clients today, starting today, if you got no more new clients, how long would stuff like savings and existing work sustain your business? And I've worked with plenty of people where they're like 6 to 12 months. And I think, God, you could do anything in that amount of time. Not literally, but there's so many things you could do in 6 to 12 months. Anyway, how do you think about risk? That's probably part of it is runway, savings, that kind of thing. But how else do you think about it?
Well, I love this question, and I just want to go ahead and promote your Consulting Pipeline podcast, because I did listen to the episode on driving to the airport, which I thought was a great analogy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'll leave it right there for our listeners. But if you're interested in hearing Philip talk about risk in a great analogy, go listen to that Consulting Pipeline podcast. The way I think about it is, I think there's still a natural fit for my existing coaching offering, right? So I think that the way this would be sold is to put the offer in front of someone and say, this is what I can offer. my economic buyer will still be the business owner, which is what I want. Yeah. I want to work directly with business owners. Mm-hmm. And my guess is the majority of the time, they'll want some level of coaching from me first before they take the time and investment to mm-hmm. put me in front of their entire team. That's my guess. Okay. They want to know, like, do I really like Liston? Is he insightful? Is he going to challenge me in the things that I think? Because what we're doing now needs to be shaken up. Right. And so my guess is my one-on-one coaching offer will still be taken up by a lot of people. Okay. So I don't think that I'm wasting or completely tearing down the existing marketing that I have.
Right. Right? So you're adding something new that's not like really that disruptive to what you're already doing.
I don't think so. And I think the second thing that I was going to say about risk is I'm pretty savvy with prospecting and reaching out to new people and getting phone calls out of thin air, which is something that we've talked about. It's not something I particularly enjoy doing, but you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that I will try for this is to put together enough of the backbone of the idea to then go out and talk to people and say, hey, I wanted to talk to you about something I'm working on, not because I want to sell it to you, but because I want to see what problems you're having, kind of the market research approach you're talking about,
right,
and see what kind of interest and excitement comes from that. And then I may be able to get a few sales without doing any direct marketing, or I should say inbound marketing, where I'm producing a bunch of content. I can write up a Google Doc and say, like, here's how it would work approximately. Is this something you'd be open to? What do you think?
I know. I love those kind of lightweight experiments. sometimes I'll do those. I mean, in a way, that's sort of, specialization school is a little more heavy than that, but it's like, in April, I'm going to be selling something that I will build in late April if right. the sales are there.
Right.
It's the same sort of, I mean, you could argue that me holding back people might feel that a bit and that might affect sales. But at the same time, it worked for the first workshop, which sold out all the seats. So I'm reasonably comfortable with that kind of, lean. I think of it as a lean approach, you know, like lean startup type approach.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess my feeling is there's not a tremendous amount of risk for me. I've been building a pipeline now for 3 months. I'm still doing other activities that will lead to more leads. Like, I can be relatively assured that basically anytime I do a webinar, I'm going to get between 2 and 5 pretty high quality leads who are serious about working with me. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn brings in several leads a month. Now I'm more or less on maintenance mode. I post twice a week and I get, you know, lots of interaction. And so there's good leads that come from there. And so I feel like I'm in a pretty good position to try this out, without sacrificing anything else that I've built at this point.
What mistakes do you see people make in trying new things with their business? Better yet, what mistakes have you made?
Again, how much time do you have, right?
We got all day here, buddy. we have, I think, infinite the biggest future episodes you want to divide this conversation up over. Could be a month-long topic.
50. Yeah. I think the biggest mistake that I often make, and there's, I forget the name of this cognitive bias, but it's true for most people. Freakonomics did an episode on this recently, that we really suck at projecting the amount of time that it takes to do something. And that's usually the mistake that I make, where I go, oh, I'll just do this and then things will happen. And I'm much better at assessing how long something will take for someone else than for myself.
It's called the planning fallacy.
Yes, thank you. The planning fallacy. So, great episode on Freakonomics recently about this very topic. And it takes a while to do stuff, right? Because if you're going to do a new initiative in your business, you have to figure out what it's going to be. You're going to have to put together the conception of it. What does this look like? You're going to have to tell some people about it. They're going to have to think about it. Then they get back to you. Then you have to schedule a call. Then they need another call, right? So now, before we know it, what we thought, oh, in 2 weeks, I'll figure this out. Maybe a 6 to 8 week endeavor. And so the problem with underestimating the amount of time something's going to take is we want to make sure that any new thing we do has leverage, because simply put, it's going to take longer than you expect, and it's going to come at the expense of doing other things. So as long as it's moving in the direction of some future endeavor that you can undertake, I'd say go for it. But that's the biggest problem that I see. And in fact, you know, I was talking to someone recently who I think needed to hit the reset button on their expectations, which is totally fine, right? Mm-hmm. As long as we know, as long as we're realistic about what's going on, what's likely to be achieved, it's totally fine. And sometimes we need help understanding that. Like I said, I'm bad at, or at least I could be a lot better at recalibrating how long I think things could or should take for myself. I think
the mistake I've made repeatedly is a variation on that. It has less to do with estimating time, but more with chrome, sort of gold plating and chrome plating things that don't need to be gold plated.
Yeah.
So it's a sort of like overdoing it, not really embracing that lean approach, I think is the problem I've done. Like, you know, you said something, I could put together a Google Doc real quick and put that offer in front of somebody. Right. That's the lean approach.
Right.
The not lean approach is, oh, I need to research the 10 different SaaS tools that are going to be necessary to pull this off and figure out how to optimize the payment collection.
Right.
So that when this immediately, you know, goes, shoots up like a bullet, I'm ready for that. And like, I wonder if the folks at home are like familiar with this kind of thinking that I'm not doing a great job of illustrating here, but it's this kind of premature optimization that I think is the problem. The thing I've fallen prey to in the past is that trap of let's over-engineer this before we even ship something that people can react to. Not even ship the product, just ship something they can react to. You know, I think about Amazon's practice of, you want to invest in some new thing? Great, write a press release for what you want us to allocate money to build, and we're going to judge it based on the merits of the press release or the sales page that you write or what have you. Like, to me, right, that's how you do the lean approach.
Yeah, I love, I think I mentioned on this podcast before in Ryan Holiday's Perennial Seller book, mm-hmm, he talks about the one sentence, one paragraph, one page method.
Yep.
And I think that is such a useful exercise to just go, okay, like who am I making this for and what does it do for them? Yep. Basically in one sentence, in one paragraph, in one page. And I think that takes a lot of the pressure off of, because really the chrome doesn't matter. What I've learned when I produce content is, you know, creating something useful is much more important than creating something perfect. So occasionally, I'll give you a perfect example. I got some hate mail last week via LinkedIn, mm-hmm, which I shared with you, yep, and my good friend Alan Weiss. Mm-hmm. And I got some nasty comments back from it. Mm-hmm. Only two. Mm-hmm. And I sent 235 one-to-one LinkedIn messages, mm-hmm, which were only slightly customized. So 10% of the people who received a message signed up for my webinar. 1% said something nasty to me. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, it's sort of like, you know, I've learned that no matter what I do in sales and marketing, some small percentage of people will be pissed off.
Yeah.
And I usually go, it's hard not to always take that personally, right? Or to not, I should say, not sometimes take that personally.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, who knows? Maybe their mom died. Maybe they're going through a divorce. Maybe it's just a bad day for whatever reason. Who knows? Maybe they just feel the need to tell everybody what's on their mind. But it also helped a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
So I can kind of live with that. I can live with the imperfection inherent in that system if I can err on the side of speed.
Yeah. There's this saying that, you know, are you playing to win or are you playing to not lose? Because there's a, it sounds like at first like a meaningless distinction, but then you're like, wait, there is a different mentality there. Playing to not lose is like, well, I'm going to be so averse to any risk and I'm just going to let that dictate how I proceed. Whereas playing to win is like, okay, you accept some riskier. You know that that is part of the game.
Right. And I'm just going to do my best, even if that means it's not perfect or it's not ideal or there's going to be some trade-offs along the way, because news, there always are, right? Especially if you're playing not to win, like you said, or not to lose, you're much more on the defensive. So rather than looking at things in the positive, you tend to look at things in the negative. Yeah. And I'd be much more of the positive growth mindset approach and just go, you know what? It's not going to be for everybody. Sorry you don't like it. Have a great day.
Well, my new goal for this podcast is to end on something that could be on a Hallmark card.
And?
I think we've done that.
Okay.
Do you think we should wrap it up here?
I think we should. I think it's time, Philip.
So what goes on the Hallmark card? Are you playing to win or are you playing to not lose? Or you said something different. You had a different variation on that.
Yeah, I think my Hallmark card would say, someone loves you even if you piss a few people off. Something like that.
Someone loves you even if you piss a few people off. I think I'm wondering if I can get a card made up that has that on it and send it to you.
That should be the cover photo of this episode, but it's not going to be.
Because we don't do cover photos for
episodes. Right, because we're not doing perfect. We're doing lo-fi and good content.
We love you guys, but not that much.
Sorry, peeps.
See you next time, Liston.
Bye, Philip.
Bye.